Welcome to episode 171 of the Sentientism podcast, a podcast about what's real and who matters. The Sentientism worldview answers those two deep questions by committing to evidence, reason, and compassion for all sentient beings. In this episode, I speak with John Sanborn Matsu. John is a writer, philosopher, cultural critic, and magician. He's best known for his book, The Postmodern Prince, and for his more recent work in critical animal studies, where he edited the collection Critical Theory and Animal Liberation. Also in that field is his book, The Omnivore's Deception, which criticizes the civilizational error of animal agriculture. It will be published by NYU Press in 2024. He is Associate Professor of Philosophy at Worcester Polytechnic Institute in Massachusetts, where he teaches ethics, politics, existentialism, and a range of other courses. In his spare time, he performs as a professional magician and mentalist. I'd love to know what you think of this episode and others in our timeless back catalogue. Why not let me know via review or rating? Reviews, ratings, and sharing with friends really helps more people find out about the Sentientism worldview, hopefully nudging the world towards more compassionate, rational thinking. You can find out more about Sentientism at our website, sentientism.info, where you can sign up for email updates, or just search for the word Sentientism, that's sentient with ism on the end, on your favourite social media platform. You'll be made very welcome in all of our global online communities. They're open to anyone interested in these sorts of ideas, not just sentientists. Thanks for listening. I think it's working. Good morning, John. How are you?
Good morning. I'm good. How are you?
Yeah, really good. Really good. Well, it's brilliant to get the chance to have a proper conversation because we've exchanged a few thoughts on Twitter here and there, but it's the first time we've sort of had a chance to look each other in the eyes and have a proper conversation. So yeah, it's great. Thank you so much for being a guest on Sentientist Conversations.
It's a great pleasure. I'm a big admirer of the show. So
thank you. It's an honor.
Honored to be here.
So you know this already because, like you say, we haven't the honor of having you as a subscriber and a watcher, but it's a series of conversations about what I think of as the deepest philosophical questions, the questions of what's real and how should we best understand this amazing universe we share, but just as importantly, the fundamental questions of ethics, what actually matters and who gets to matter in our ethics. And I have an obvious bias because I'm trying to frame and popularize and develop this really simple, pluralistic, basic worldview that I'm calling sentientism, which in a sentence is evidence, reason, and compassion for all sentient beings. So when we think about what's real and how to understand the world, it suggests a naturalistic approach using evidence and reason, and hopefully a healthy dose of humility and doubt and skepticism. And on the ethical side, the ethical scope question, the clue is in the name, that it suggests that at least every sentient being, every being that has the capacity to have experiences, to suffer, to flourish, to experience anything at all, should warrant compassion and moral consideration in our ethical systems. But I'm lucky to talk to a dazzling array of guests, some of whom agree and some of whom disagree. So it'll be fascinating to understand your own philosophical journey and how it plays in. And so much of your work hits those central ethical and epistemological questions pretty hard too. And it was an honor to have a chance to read the outline and the introductory chapter of your forthcoming book, The Omnivore's Deception, which is, even just on that sort of cursory reading, looks like it's going to be a complete tour de force. So I look forward to the book coming out. And I think we'll explore some of those themes as we go through these questions today. So yeah, thank you for sharing that with me.
Terrific, sure.
So before we get onto those big questions, how would you best introduce yourself and your work for people who don't know you?
You know, I was looking over to some questions for this interview. I think that's the hardest one. You know, I'm a philosopher. That's what I do professionally, but I'm also, I see myself as a critical theorist. So the critical theorist begins from the perspective of the world being unfree and works from there. How do we build a world that is free rather than unfree? So, you know, since I was a kid, I've been very interested in justice, social justice for all beings. And so I've been active in various social movements over the years. I think my first was in college. I was involved in the anti-nuclear movement, what was then called the Nuclear Freeze Campaign. This was an attempt to slow and reverse the nuclear arms race, primarily between the Soviet Union and the United States. And then I got involved in the solidarity movement around U.S. intervention in Central America. My government was supporting death squads and counter-revolutionary movements throughout the Americas, particularly South, you know, at that time, Central America. So, you know, when you become interested in claims of justice, it's a slippery slope, and you begin, you know, you kind of broaden yourself out from there. So, yeah, so eventually in college, I read Peter Singer's very famous essay he wrote called Famine, Affluence, and Morality, a classic utilitarian theory arguing that we should all give 90% of our income, if we lived in the northern richer countries, to people who were starving in Bangladesh at the time. And then I came across Singer's book, Animal Liberation, in a bookstore, and that turned me into a vegetarian. So got me on this path. So I'm originally from Massachusetts, from Plymouth, Massachusetts, where some of your ancestors came over on the Mayflower. And yeah, so I grew up here in Massachusetts. I mean, I live in the Boston area now. But that's kind of, so some of my concerns, I guess, are oriented around liberation and justice.
Yeah, that's great. Some good seeds for later in the conversation too. And I understand you're a magician as well.
Oh, thank you for mentioning that. Yes, yes. Especially before the pandemic, I had a part-time business as a professional magician and mentalist. Yeah, that may come up in this conversation, actually. There's some interesting things I might say about that. But yes, so I do that as well.
Yeah, that's great. Thank you. Well, let's start with the first of these big philosophical questions, the question of what's real. And that's a broad topic. I mean, it's all of epistemology, really. But it's quite interesting to start off with a personal journey. And for many people, that's a story about whether my guests grew up originally in maybe a more religious or a spiritual or a mystically minded household and society, or one that was more naturalistic or atheistic or scientifically minded, or a mix of both, and how that side of their thinking about the sort of big picture nature of our reality and how to believe it has changed over time, if it has. So, yeah, it'd be interesting to know your story on that front.
Yeah, it's really interesting when I was thinking about, how did I come to we all have this private metaphysical world of, you know, what's real and what isn't. And then epistemologically, what proofs do we need to know what's real? I was brought up Unitarian. My father was pretty much an atheist. And my mother was Jewish, but mostly a secular Jew. And I kind of think they met in the middle.
Yeah.
So I was raised Unitarian in America's oldest congregational church in Plymouth, which is actually traces back to the Pilgrims, although the Pilgrims would have been horrified by the liberalism of the Unitarian, modern Unitarian church.
Yeah.
Because my mother's Jewish, we would celebrate Passover with a Jewish family every year. And I mention it because that narrative, that's this wonderful story of Passover and the liberation of the Jews, is a narrative about freedom. But it's also, it isn't just the freedom of the Jewish people, but there's a sense in that story of kind of more general liberation. So these were some of the ethical values that kind of I started with. In terms of what's real, it's interesting. I mentioned, you know, being a magician in the 1970s when I was growing up. This was, you look a little young, but at the time, you know, in the 70s, people believed in psychic phenomena. This was a kind of a common thing. There were television shows about it. Scientists were investigating it. There was also a lot of, this is when belief in abductions by UFOs kind of became popular. There was a book published called The Secret Lives of Plants. So the 70s was this kind of interesting moment of ferment around supernaturalism and almost animism. Like, you had the sense anyway of a world that was just, it was very interesting. You know, maybe there are aliens here, maybe the plants were listening to us.
Yeah.
Uri Geller, the great Israeli spoon bender, was a big inspiration to me at the time. I would spend hours in my room trying to move pennies with my mind, you know, telekinesis, psychokinesis. And so what I thought was real at the time, it turns out wasn't real. I mean, I do believe that we, you know, the stuff we don't know for sure, and including probably some psychic phenomena that are real that we just don't have a scientific explanation for yet. But at any rate, as a child, kind of in a teenager, that was my world. But I would say, you know, we form our view of what's real based on our experiences, right? Our own experiences. So it wasn't just a theoretical thing. It wasn't just my religious upbringing. You know, my father is Japanese and was Japanese American from the West Coast. And I grew up in a completely white town in New England. And I experienced a lot of racism. And that experience was real. I mean, that was my fun, you know, that the trauma from that and the way that ordinary events were shot through with the potential for harm or vulnerability, I think that really grounded me in a certain experience of, let's say an attentiveness towards suffering. My own suffering, suffering of other people. Charles Mills, the critical race theorist, he has a discussion of Descartes in Blackness Visible, where he, you know, Descartes' whole idea is, well, I think, therefore I am, right? Cogito ergo sum. And Mills points out that, you know, that isn't a problem Black people are asking, you know, do I really exist? They know they exist because they're getting, you know, beaten up, you know, that they're aware that their body's real. They can't doubt that. It takes a certain privileged position to doubt your corporeal reality. And since I was getting beaten up as a kid,
that was pretty real.
That was pretty real. Yeah, that was pretty real. And so when you're out on the outside of a social system or circle, and I think this is true of a lot of people in the animal movement, is that people who grew up with trauma or with some awareness of the way power worked, right, and the injustices of power, I think that for a lot of people in the movement, it ended up helping them, you know, empathize with non-human beings who are the ultimate other, right? We construct our whole, speaking of reality, our whole reality around, you know, the animal other. And the last thing I'll say about what's real in this context in terms of my own, you know, kind of education was, we grew up with cats and dogs. And, you know, and the more I've thought about that over the years, even though none of us, you know, we weren't raised vegetarian or anything, so there were these contradictions, that was very significant. I mean, that my parents really loved our companion animals and took very good care of them. So as a boy, you know, I loved being outside in nature and so forth. So these experiences also were really formative for me.
Yeah. And I think there's something deeply important that flows through that, because when I talk about, you know, a naturalistic epistemology, and I use the terms like using evidence and reason, some people will immediately jump to thinking it's a very narrowly scientific view, that it has to be, you know, the result of a randomized control trial done by, you know, men in white coats in a lab somewhere. And beyond that, you know, that is the only sort of evidence. And I don't think that's what naturalism means at all. I think of evidence in an enormously rich sense that absolutely includes our own experiences. And ultimately, all evidence comes through our experience. There's nothing else. So I think of our personal experiences as absolutely being a component of evidence. And of course, you know, we could be skeptical of our own experiences and our perceptions. You know, we weren't designed to be some sort of perfect understanders of reality, right? So we can be skeptical of evidence, of our senses and our experience, just like any other evidence, but it is evidence, right?
Oh, absolutely. I just want to really underscore what you said. That, I mean, it's such an important thing to say. I mean, we're in this positivistic, scientistic paradigm of knowing, in a way of knowing, and so we tend to dismiss or somehow view skeptically the knowledge that we gain through our own bodies, through our own senses. And so I'm very sympathetic to and have worked a little bit in the tradition of phenomenology, existential phenomenology. Maurice Merleau-Ponty, for example, the French philosopher, who wrote, you know, a book called The Phenomenology of Perception. I mean, look, science can be wonderfully useful for all sorts of ways of knowing the world. But my God, I mean, modern scientific tradition is only from, you know, say the 16th, 17th centuries, whereas we've been knowing the world getting reliable information, knowledge of the world, of self and other, and the world around us for literally hundreds of thousands of years, hundreds of thousands of years. And it's these bodies of ours that allow us access to the experiences of others through empathy. That's a mammalian and not even simply mammalian capacity that we share with many, many other beings. And so I think it's really important that we understand and not feel apologetic about the fact that we have feelings, that we have intuitions, that we have empathic capacities, which I think of empathy as a kind of sixth sense, right? It's a mode of perception. It's really being able to perceive and experience vicariously, you know, but what's going on with the other. So yes, absolutely. That's another, I think that's it's the primary way we know the world. We don't know the world through mathematics. We don't know the world through physical models. This is, you know, the fact that, you know, we're having this mediated exchange, still it's like where you and I are in a kind of moment of connection that's real, and we're learning from each other, not just intellectually, but, you know, emotionally and subliminally, I would say.
Yeah, I agree. And you hinted at it there. I'm lucky enough to sometimes run workshops with school kids in the UK, talking about a variety of different sort of non-religious worldviews and some of the basics of philosophy, which is just an enormous buzz. But one of the things I'll sometimes say to them when I'm talking about, you know, naturalistic way of understanding the world, is that in a way, that's pretty much what their younger brothers and sisters, who might be, you know, 2 or 3 years old, do anyway. You know, it's before they've really learned anything formally. It's before they've been told things that probably aren't true, but they are just honestly engaging with the world and trying to understand it. And of course, they'll make mistakes and so on. But in a way, they're like little naturalists. And as you said, it's not just a human thing either, right? For, you know, hundreds of millions of years before we came on the scene, I would argue that, I'm not claiming that non-human animals necessarily have a formal epistemology, but they're using evidence and they're using reasoning to try and understand the environment they're in, understand each other, understand themselves, and to survive and replicate and do what they're doing, right? This is not some distinct, magical, separate human thing we've created. Yeah.
No, yeah, no, I just want to say, I totally agree. I mean, that other animals are empiricists. I mean, you know, I mean, quite literally, like, you know, chimps will have been observed to throw rocks behind an object that's in water to cause ripples so that the object will come closer. You know, jays have been, you know, the experiments with corvids have shown that there's an object at the bottom of a glass, you know, they know to add water to raise thing. They also understand the different substances, how different materials displace water, you know, so they have a kind of a sense of the physics of volume. Seagulls dropping mussel shells, you know, from a height, they'll try different surfaces, they'll try different heights to multiply the force of gravity. So yeah, there's all sorts of ways that we diminish the capacities of and intelligence of other beings, but they are knowers. We're not the, you know, Homo sapiens. You know, we're the knower. We're not the only knower. And to be honest, you know, that whole fetish of a certain narrow conception of reason leads to vast ignorance in our species. So we forget these earlier modes, ancient primordial modes of knowing the world. And then, as I say, we tend to diminish them, or that's not the word I'm looking for, but you know what I'm saying.
Yeah, yeah. And one criticism that I hear of, I guess, the critical studies field in general, but also postmodernism, is that sometimes parts of those movements can take our line of thinking too far, such that they can almost focus so much on the value of individual subjective experience that they deny there is any objective truth. I've heard it called a standpoint epistemology. And I think my impression is that comes from a good place. It comes from respecting perspectives of the other. But my personal view is that does go too far, right? If it almost becomes a sort of solipsistic sense that each of us are our own islands and our own perspective is inviolable and unchallengeable and incommunicable and completely distinct from everybody else around us. Whereas you know, I think it's most likely that we do all share one universe. We are evolved entities moving around it and interacting. We'll never understand each other perfectly, but we can understand each other enough to collaborate and communicate and to understand and at least to grasp at some possible shared truth, even if we never quite get there. And I think in the Postmodern Prince, I think that was one of the themes. If I haven't had a chance to read the book, from my understanding of the summary, that's one of the themes you talked about there. I'd be interested in your view on postmodernism and critical theory and how it engages with the possibility of objective truth.
Yeah, a very interesting set of questions. I mean, so the critical tradition, you know, as we're talking about it here, really, it begins more or less with Marx and Karl Marx and the and other socialist and anarchist left thinkers in the 19th century, right? And then, you know, not to rehearse all of that, but it began with a kind of Hegelian perspective and was tied to the praxis of social movements in Europe at the time, you know, revolutionary movements. The theorists were simply trying to catch up with what was going on the ground, right? So there's a sense in which theory and practice are linked and so on. Now, my book, The Postmodern Prince, is really trying to give a genealogy of how postmodernism developed, or post-structuralist theoretical currents developed within the humanities in France, especially, and then in other countries, including the United States, and what impact that had on our ability to think practically and critically about society and so on. So I'm kind of a critic of postmodernism, right? So there are these different elements within critical theory. And so I'm part of the tradition that identifies more with what's called Western Marxism. So that's the early Frankfurt School, Theodor Adorno, Max Horkheimer, Herbert Marcuse, radical feminist theory I've been influenced by. And I could talk about some other influences on my work, but I think the problem, as you say, is that, see, the post-structuralist move is really to say that it's a move away from the experiential, right, and a reaction against humanism. And the humanistic ideal was that we could arrive at a universal truth, or at least a universal language for talking about the human condition, human experiences, right? That's the kind of universality that you're mentioning. The grain of truth to post-structuralist critique is that, look, you and I, we're not just guys sitting there, that there are these vectors of force, of history, discourse, power, you know, that we can call gender, race, class, and not just those three, the triumvirate, you know, but all sorts of other things that have impinged on our subjectivity and have created a ground for knowing the world and for the assumptions that we bring to the world, right? So that's true. You know, Michel Foucault, the French philosopher and historian, talked about pouvoir, power, and discourse, and the way discourse creates our experiences of truth. So Foucault put truth in brackets. Truth is just becomes a kind of discourse. Truth becomes a way of creating power relations. Well, you know, there's something to that, but you know, feeling,
descriptively, that is sort of how things happen.
Yeah, right? Sure. Yeah. But you don't want to throw the baby out with the bath, yeah, proverbially, right? And I, you know, you don't have to lapse into a kind of naive view of truth, a referential view of truth that just takes for granted the givenness of the world, to nonetheless realize that truth claims really matter. And they matter, and I would say that a truth claim has an ontological dimension. It isn't just, in other words, when we refer to some aspect of the world, now, and a lot of philosophers will disagree with me, I think we are talking about something, you know, that's actually real, you know.
At least probabilistically, you know, there's a decent chance of it.
You know, I can't remember the philosopher who talks about truthiness. You know, like there's a kind of fluctuation around a norm. Well, there's still something there.
Yeah.
But at any rate, I think, you know, the best of what's called the now kind of critical phenomenology, right, acknowledges the fact that you and I, our perspectives have been shaped by gender, say, in ways that we're not even aware of, and that we can do a phenomenology, which is to say a kind of rich description of our experiences, of the structures of our consciousness, how things in the world come to appear for us. We can understand that through understanding gender, socialization. But that doesn't exhaust what we can say about each other. And it doesn't mean that we don't share a whole bunch of similar existential, right, and psychological conditions and structures. Standpoint epistemology, which is a term from feminist theory, standpoint epistemology says that based on where you are in a certain social hierarchy, if you're on the bottom of that, you tend to have a privileged vantage point on the structure, right? You know, the person who's in power, the boss, walks into the office and just struts to, you know, their office and doesn't notice the other people because they don't have to. Whereas, you know, all the workers, their attention is cut. So the point there is not that if you're a marginalized or oppressed person, you have, you know, the God's truth of everything. It does mean that you tend to have a better epistemological vantage point for understanding social structure. And I think that's right. I mean, this goes back to Hegel, Hegel's master-slave dialectic, same idea, you know, the slave or the servant is in the position of the subordinate and therefore has a view of the totality. Yeah. Now, I mentioned—
And that's because of the experiences that they've had and because of the evidence they have through those experiences that others don't have, right? I mean, it's quite straightforward. It's not so—
Yeah, no, I'm glad you said that. You know, it just made me think. I was talking to a very good friend of mine from high school who I hadn't talked to in a few years, and I haven't seen him in many, many years. And my friend is white. His parents were German immigrants. And as I say, grew up in Plymouth, Massachusetts. And somehow the subject of racism came up and my experiences of that. And my friend, who was my dearest friend, right, for many, many years, you know, we were best buds in junior high school and high school. He had no idea that I had had these experiences. Now, these were like some of the most salient experiences of my life.
Yeah.
Because I had experienced racism from the time I was like 3. I mean, and I would be attacked by other children, adults, even teachers. But because he's white, he'd never had those experiences, and those kinds of, and the racism in my experience tended to be in one-on-one private channels, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So there was this whole realm of experience that my friend was ignorant of and wasn't, and that's, you know, so when critical race theories talk about white privilege, that's really what they're talking about. And it's not like my friend was a bad person or anything. It's just that he, just because of where he was in the hierarchy, he just didn't have to deal with that stuff and didn't understand, and therefore he doesn't understand, I think, even now, what racism really is, you know, as a kind of lived experience or a structure. So anyway, I'm sorry to go off on that tangent.
No, that's really helpful, because again, it's just clarifying, again, the people challenging these stances often paint a caricature to make it easy to attack. So it's really helpful to lay that out as what standpoint epistemology is. It's not a denial of objective truth. It's not a denial that we can share and understand each other's experience to a degree, but it is a recognition that our life course gives us a distinct set of experiences that may give us particular, you know, privileged or less privileged access to understanding of the world as it is. Yeah.
And, you know, and Jamie, you use the word humility. You use that in introducing this topic and how we should think about, you know, engage in the world. And I think that's really right. I mean, I think that all of us, wherever we are, you know, in the position of society, we need to be open to to new possibilities. So, you know, if someone, you know, a man thinks, oh, well, you're just, tells a woman, well, you're just paranoid. You know, you think men are always looking at you or looking at your breasts or something like that. It's like, well, wait a minute. Like, why are you so certain of that? Why don't you listen? You know, listening to other people, being compassionate, having empathy. Now, the thing is, empathy can be interrupted by these structures, right? The quote prejudices we have, or the our socialization can get in the way of our understanding the other and having compassion for the other. So this is where the post-structuralists are not completely wrong. But personally, I just don't find it to be overall a very helpful way of looking at the world. For example, you know, we're talking about animals, right? Other species. Well, you know, I've been reflecting on the animals of non-human animals I've lived with, right? And when I think about my childhood and the cats and dogs we had, the cats had their own Lebenswelt, as we would say in German, their own life world that was particular to their species. I mean, they had incredibly heightened senses, right? And they saw and smelled things that we couldn't see or smell or hear. And so we couldn't really, there was an epistemological abyss between us to some extent, no question, right? And their otherness is something to acknowledge and to honor. They're not human. They're not me, you know, but I don't have to incorporate them into my world for them to have value. And the other, so even though they had their own life world, as we'd say, like their own experiential reality, it overlapped with ours. These things are true. Two things can be true at once. People have I don't know why. It's not that difficult, right?
We love binaries. Yeah.
You know, yeah. So we even as kids, obviously, a child knows that the dog and the cat don't know what the humans know. They know that. It's just like obvious. And yet, you know, when the cat goes to the door and looks inquiringly like, yeah, let me out, you know, they communicate with us. And we can empathize with them, and they can even empathize with us. So that's the tricky thing. We need to be able to acknowledge, right, our differences from the other, whether that's another human being from a different culture or different gender, whatever, that their experiences may not be our own, and we can learn from them what, you know, what that's about. And even with non-humans, we can learn from them. They can't speak to us in, you know, most cases, unless they're Kanzi, the chimp, or Alex, the parrot, or whatever. But, you know, we can attend to them and have a sense of what their needs are and their experiences.
Yeah. And it's another interesting area where, I guess, ethics and epistemology link. Some people like to try and keep the two completely distinct and separate, but everywhere I look, I just see links between the two, particularly with bad epistemology feeding bad ethics and bad ethics feeding bad epistemology. But that was another interesting example where actually, if you struggle to have empathy, you're going to find it difficult to learn from the perspectives of others. And if you struggle to have that humility, again, you're going to struggle to learn and improve your knowledge of the world. And just to wrap up this section about what's real, I get the impression that you probably have a broadly naturalistic worldview in that sense we're discussing, and that you've, you know, moved away from thinking Uri Geller is really doing real magic. I'm assuming you don't hold them onto any of the sort of supernatural beliefs from Unitarianism you had before, although put me right if I'm wrong. So it's broadly naturalistic, but at the same time, within that, there is this rich appreciation for other perspectives and a sense of needing humility, which to my mind should be central to a naturalistic worldview. Is that a sort of fair summary, or are there bits I'm missing? Is there still some space for the supernatural or things beyond or other modes of knowing beyond evidence and reason?
I just want to say that the Unitarian church I went to was very anti-metaphysical and anti-supernatural. I mean,
that's quite common in the Unitarian church, isn't it, as I understand.
Yeah, like I had a Bible studies class, and our minister, we went through the Bible, and he just showed how everything couldn't possibly have happened, or there was a naturalistic explanation of it. So I didn't have to adjust my worldview very much. No, I don't believe in supernaturalism per se. As I say, I am open to psychic experiences as a like certain limited ones as a possibility. But I don't, you know, I don't think it's magic. I think that we don't understand quantum physics, or, you know,
stuff we don't know yet or may never find out.
And we will never know. And I think that's really important. I mean, most people don't realize that right now, scientists don't know what 97% of the universe consists of, right? They call it dark matter and dark energy, which just means We have no idea what it is.
Yeah, we know it has a gravitational pull on other stuff, but that's sort of it.
Yeah, right.
We've got some candidates, WIMPs and axions and so on. But yeah, yeah, absolutely. And that's most of the stuff.
Yeah, so, you know, I don't know. I mean, I do. I don't believe in an afterlife. I don't believe in a supreme being. I think these are ludicrous ideas, personally. But having said that, I think I've become more open to talking about a kind of spirituality, is how I guess I would put it. And it, because I think you had Philip McKinnon on your program, yeah. You know, and he was talking about a politics of love. And, you know, I've been coming around more and more to the importance of love as the kind of providing us almost with an ontological ground for knowledge and for meaning in life. And that's a spiritual view. You know, the idea that the world is better for us to help others is a spiritual view, right? As opposed to the utilitarian view, which is that suffering is bad, pleasure is good. You know, you don't have to be have any spiritual anything to be a utilitarian. You just follow abstract principles. I mean, you could just be a robot or a psychopath, right? Psychopaths would make wonderful utilitarians because they can do the math and they don't have to think about the feelings, right? But I do think, even though, as you say, I'm not a supernaturalist anymore, although I certainly create the illusion of that in my act, but I do believe that, you know, that squishy word, or, you know, we often shy away from spiritualism or spirituality is something we should take seriously.
Yeah, thank you. And does it destroy the romance and the beauty of love if it just happens to be a pattern of information processing going on in the neural networks in my head? Because in a way, I'm quite open to, you know, obviously I think love is a deeply important thing, and I can also appreciate a naturalistic version of the spirituality as well, in that sense of a sense of connectedness and a sense of, you know, almost oneness. But to my mind, because I'm quite a hard-edged naturalist, ultimately that really just does come down to physics and maths and all that sort of stuff. It doesn't, and that doesn't lose the wonder for me, whereas for other people it feels like you've lost the wonder if you don't leave some space for something beyond.
I guess what I'd say is this, that I don't agree that love is information processing. I think that, like, that language, I know you were kind of being a little bit, you know, flippant there, but that language, right, we can draw a straight line to René Descartes, 17th century, and the idea of living beings being machines. The fact that in order to, for my, me to have consciousness and have these experiences that I'm having with you, I need there's a physical process going on that makes it possible for that to happen. But the phenomenon of consciousness isn't the physical thing that's going on. There's some, right, this is the problem that philosophers of mind continue to, you know, bandy about. We don't really understand what consciousness is, but we do know this, okay, that it isn't information and it isn't physical process. It's something else. Why? Because we know it is when we're it doesn't have a it's not in time space. It's in the moment. And so that to me is, I think it's really important to validate when, you know, in terms of sentientism, is to think about the integrity of consciousness as something that eludes and will always elude physical description. The map is not the territory. It never will be. There's no way. It's a category mistake. We can't describe something that exists outside a physical realm in physicalist language. That's not it. And so it's sort of like the way you can live with someone your entire life and they'll do something that, like, surprises you. There's no way you're going to map that. I don't care how fast quantum computers get. There's no way. That's the nature of consciousness, that it's a singularity. That's what I think of as a singularity, is that it's itself alone. And again, yes, there are these physical things that make possible the emergence of this phenomenon, but the phenomenon it can't be just described using physical or naturalistic formulae, I think.
Thank you. And one of the interesting things about the guests I've had so far, and also the way I try and frame sentientism, is that it's actually neutral on philosophy of mind as well as lots of other things. So it's almost saying that sentience is the capacity to have experiences, and that matters whether or not you think it is just a pattern of information processing, whether you think it's a sort of dual nature of character, whether you think it is some distinct phenomenon, whether you're a panpsychist. You know, it almost doesn't matter. What matters is that for that being, it feels like something, and that's morally salient. So, and it's interesting because my own personal view, and many of my guests and many other sentientists disagree with me, is that where Descartes went wrong was not recognizing that, you know, animals are machines with mechanistic processes going on. I think he's right about that. And I think if he examined humans, he'd come up with the same conclusion. The error he made was actually positing that consciousness, or in his case, the soul, was something distinct that existed that he couldn't find in the animals. And so I think the reason he, you know, apocryphally tortured his wife's dog was because he examined the wife's dog, found only mechanistic processes, said, I can't see a soul here, so it cannot be suffering. Whereas actually, those mechanistic processes are the sentience, and they really matter. So in a way, by Descartes positing what you're saying, which is there must be something distinct from the physical, led him to that brutality, where I think if we have, you know, at least open-mindedness about the fact it might just be that information processing. And I know it's counterintuitive, but I genuinely think that what I'm experiencing now is just what it feels like to run this class of information processing. That doesn't devalue it to me at all. That still is just as morally salient as if consciousness was phenomenally distinct. I don't think it matters either way. And again, we're not going to put philosophy of mind to bed here, but in a sense, I'm almost suggesting I find that whole topic deeply fascinating. But I worry about it, the answers being morally salient, because ultimately, whether my consciousness is phenomenally distinct or whether it's a pattern of information processing, if I stick a fork in the back of my hand, that hurts and that matters. And I don't really care what the philosophy of mind is that underpins that. And I'm nervous that any particular philosophy of mind might lead us to ignore certain aspects of consciousness or sentience.
Well, if I may jump in, I think the problem with reducing consciousness to information processing is that, and we're seeing this a lot now, right now, everyone, well, plants are sentient. My computer's sentient. Why? Because it's information processing.
An electron buzzing around the atom, yeah.
So it begins with this conflation between information processing and intelligence, right? The Turing test thing, and well, it's just processing. So, and that's, then we define that as intelligence. And then there's this further slippage that intelligence is somehow consciousness, which then kind of bleeds into sentience.
Yeah.
You know, and I think, and so I disagree with the panpsychists, and I also, and I think it's, and I disagree with this AI, the idea that machines are ever going to become conscious or sentient. And I think it's really unhelpful because it's unhelpful ethically, right? Because as you say, you know, it's just something different. If someone stabs you with a fork, whereas I stab my teacup here with a fork, I'm sorry, you know, panpsychists, but no, they're not. It's not the same thing.
Yeah, no, and I agree. And the way I think there is a risk there. There's absolutely a risk of slippage. And for me, the evolutionary perspective finds a way through that, because I don't think all information processing is consciousness or sentience, like in a way the panpsychists do. They're almost saying it's primordial and foundational, it's the basis of all physics. And I disagree with that. I think information processing is really just an evolved class of information processing. And evolution gives us, for me, a really convincing understanding of why that came into being, given how biology has developed since the Precambrian. And some of my previous guests, Mark Solms and Walter Veit, sort of told that story about whether it was through pathological complexity or unlimited associative learning, really simple animals developing the capability to sense the environment, work out what's good or bad, go towards the good, go away from the bad. I think that was probably the genesis of sentience and consciousness. So that restricts it. It's not all information processing. It's just that sort of particular evolved class. And we can understand adaptively why that came to be and how it operates now. But yeah, it's interesting to explore because there's so many different points of view on.
You're going to have to have another podcast on philosophy of mind. That's all.
Completely. I want to respect your time as well, because I could talk to you all day. But let's come on to the second big question, and we might as well manage them both together. And it is the question of ethics and what matters and who matters. And for people with a more broadly, people with a strongly religious point of view, often the ethics comes as part of the package, right? There's a deity, there's a book of rules, there's divine command theory. You know, to my mind, often that's driven more by an obedience and a compliance ethic than it is genuine ethics, but let's put that to one side. But for people with a more broadly naturalistic worldview, it's an interesting question to say, well, why does anything matter to you? What matters to you? You know, why aren't you a nihilist? Why aren't you a relativist? You know, what's the grounding of your ethics, if there is one? And you've already given some hints, because you've talked about justice and freedom and suffering and love, but how would you frame, you know, what matters to you? If is there a grounding to your ethics? And then we can come on to who matters and how did you go through that journey of thinking about who gets to qualify?
Yeah, so in college, you know, I, as I said, I read Peter Singer, and at that point, from that point on, I thought of myself as a utilitarian. I still joke that I think of myself as a recovering utilitarian. You know, in terms of my doctrinal commitments, as it were, I mean, I am, like you, pretty pluralistic. But I think we can get a lot out of the phenomenology of sympathy, phenomenology of empathy. There's been a lot of great work done by feminist care ethicists like Josephine Donovan, Maurice Hamilton. Arnett Vetlason has a wonderful book called Perception, Empathy, and Judgment. And I think as moral beings, we're only able to perceive morally salient situations because we have a capacity for empathy. So that's naturalistic in the sense that it's part of our equipage, right? But it's really, there's an ontology to this, and that's a term we haven't used today. But I mean, I think that ontology is prior to ethics, right? I mean, you've had many guests on your show, right, that talk about, well, you know, what, why does sentience matter? So if we want, if I want to know how I ought to treat a cat, say, I need to understand what a cat is. That's an ontological question. What is the being of the cat? You know, what does that mean? You know, and we know, well, a cat is a consciousness. A cat has a point of view. A cat has experiences. You know, some philosophers called non-human beings persons. I think that's absolutely right. You know, that they have their own integrity of experience. When we talk about experience or sentience, it's in a vacuum unless we're talking about a particular being who has those things. A person or a someone. You know, there's also some theorists talk about a someone. There's someone home, is how Donaldson and Kimlicka talk about it in Zoopolis.
It's not some abstract quality or quantity.
Yeah, well, exactly. And that's right.
Yeah.
And that's the problem with the utilitarian view is, oh, well, suffering is bad, as though you could have, you know, you could have some suffering here. And then, oh, I got to care about that because there's some suffering in this thing. The beings are almost like vessels of, it's not like that. That's not, we can do a phenomenology of our own experience. That isn't what it's like to be a person, to be a knowing, feeling thing. So I do think, so phenomenology of empathy. Also, I'm a big fan of Martin Buber's philosophy of the I and the thou, I and thou, where we enter a dialogic relationship with the other without any prior conceptions, any preconceptions, and without any desire to mold them into our categories, where we're not trying to muscle their attributes into some schema that we can grasp with our minds, or worse, to manipulate and control them, right? Which is what Buber calls the realm of the I-it, where I treat the other as an it. And to some extent, and Kant talks about this, right, that we should never treat another rational being, he says, as a means to our ends. I'm sorry. Yeah, as a means to our ends.
Yeah.
Merely. Meaning, you know, you're treating me as a means to your end in the sense that, well, you're interviewing someone for your podcast and your channel. But if you were only to treat me that way, then I would be treated in, you know, like a thing. You would just, you know, you wouldn't be kind, and you would, you know, you wouldn't show me respect. And so similar to Martin Buber's idea, right? That, and I think that we can, view others as a thou, which is simply the archaic English term for you, an intimate you, I can, even if there's an insect in my apartment, I can view this being and enter into a kind of relation, a limited one, but of respect and a kind of receptivity to their theirness, their presence, without having to schematize, right? There's that that film, I'm sure you've seen, My Octopus Teacher.
Yeah.
Right, where the diver goes down and he becomes friends with this octopus. And this film is very tragic in certain ways, because what the man is experiencing, and it's getting back to this question of our senses and perceptions, right? He is experiencing this octopus as an individual person who is unlike all other octopuses who've ever been, that this octopus is its own being. But then there are these inflection points in the film where he lets the scientific, rationalizing, schematizing thing come between him and this being. So when the spoiler alert for folks who haven't seen the film, it's a scene where the octopus is attacked by a shark. But he's not going to interfere, because that's somehow wrong to interfere with the natural order. Well, everything the guy has done up until this point is interference in the natural order. He's gone down there in his scuba gear, which has been manufactured in Thailand or you know, put together by some sweatshop worker somewhere. I mean, he's got his camera. It's just that's made with petroleum. Everything he's done is an intervention. But then when it comes to showing solidarity with this other being, you know, so here we have, I just want to talk about this, because what matters to me is compassion and a recognition that the self is an illusion, to the extent that myself is merely, I have to understand, and I can understand myself, it's only one self of many, many selves. And that if this other person suffers, it might as well be me suffering. It is me suffering. It's just, it's a different me suffering. And so the diver in the film has this incredible empathy for this individual octopus, but then because of masculinity and science, he shuts it all down and does not show solidarity with his friend, because he's now become friends with this creature. You know?
And that's a powerful example, because you and I, one of the conversations we're having was around my conversation with Peter Singer recently. And I was talking about how I guess we all start off in a way with quite an intuitive care-based ethic, you know, friends and family and those around us. And one of the things that all sorts of moral philosophy does, you know, utilitarianism, but, you know, Kantian thinking and, you know, Rawlsian stuff and, you know, whatever the list goes on. One of the things that moral philosophy is very good at is saying, look, that's not enough. We need to go broader, right, and bigger, and extend our moral scope and consider beings we don't necessarily have relations with, you know, they all matter too. So in one sense, it's really good at doing that and busting that view open from a sort of parochial, local, transactional stance, breaking it open. But then, as you're implying, it then risks, because as you take on this point of view of the universe, you've detached from the sentient beings themselves, and you've then lost that solidarity and that care and that identification with the individual other, because ultimately they're the things that, yeah, they're the beings that matter. That's why it was so important to extend our moral scope in the first place. But there's still, I still think there's a risk there, because even if we respond to that and say, no, we need to re-engage with the individual sentient other, and we need to re-engage with a more care-based ethic and a solidarity-based ethic, there is also a danger that does then become much more localized and much more almost transactional. So I'm worried that a care ethic might lead us to narrow our moral scope just to those around us and, you know, those we engage with on a day-to-day basis. And, you know, I'd like to get the best of both worlds, really. I want a really expansive moral scope, but also that real deep appreciation and empathy with each of the individual sentient others, even though that's extremely hard because there are, you know, sextillions of them. I don't know. I should put a question in there, really. But
no, it's so interesting. And there's so many different issues here. You know, I come back to this comment that Barbara Deming made. Barbara Deming was a feminist, nonviolent activist and theorist. writing mostly in the 80s, you know. And Deming says, look, we can't, you know, we can't get to know every human being on the earth, but we can still, we can imagine what it is like to be another person. You know, Terence, the former slave on the second century BC, you know, talks about, very famously says, you know, nothing human is alien to me. We can understand that a human being is worth loving, even if we don't know them in particular. Now, critics of feminist care ethics, you know, have rightly pointed out, I mean, in some versions of it, that it can lead to a kind of parochialism or narrowness, but I don't think it has to. I mean, if I read a story in the paper about, oh my God, that horrible case of the migrants coming over to Greece, you know, 700 or so or more people crammed onto this vessel, and then something like 500 women and children below deck, and they all drowned, I can feel sorrow and horror and rage, you know, because I can care about them, even though they're strangers, because I know what it must have been like for them. In the same way, I can, even though I'm not a pig or a cow, and they're such different, you know, forms of consciousness, I can know what it's like. I can imagine, I can imagine what it's like, you know, to be prodded with an electric prod, or to feel that despair and isolation. Right? So I think the problem with utilitarianism is it kind of misses the forest for the trees, because, you know, the utilitarian asks us to, in a way, care about suffering, but not whether the being necessarily lives or dies, right? This is Singer's thing about certain kinds of animals and what their experiences are. So suppose I say, you know, someone says, well, I care about your kid, but I'm going to kill your kid. I don't want your kid to suffer. I would say that is a dissociative and almost psychopathic view of my kid. And I think in utilitarianism, the utilitarian forgets that suffering and pleasure mean nothing except to a person. But utilitarianism doesn't have respect for persons fundamentally, right? Which is why in one of Peter Singer's early books, he advocates killing severely disabled infants. You know, if a child with Down syndrome is born and the parents don't want it, well, it should be killed, you know, because it'll drag on social resources. And there's a fundamental disrespect, right, for the individual that has always been there in utilitarianism. And you just can't get it out. You know, it's like out, out, damn spot. You can't get it out. So, you know, we're in agreement. Absolutely. You know, we need a kind of like a cosmic empathy. And I think that's possible. I think it's possible that I can, if I hear about the suffering of some creature on another planet, I might be, oh my God, that's horrifying. And I wish that being well, you know, from a point of view of love and compassion. But I don't think these are mutually exclusive. I think we can have a universalist ethics and an objectivist kind of ethics out of a caring approach and an empathetic approach.
Yeah, yeah. Thank you. And I think I get the impression that there are quite a few utilitarians who are trying to adapt it. You know, they're trying to move away from the container view, and they're trying to reconnect with the value of the individual sentient being, and, you know, that's the only context in which utility makes sense. But yeah, I get the impression that it, you know, I understand that it's difficult because there is a sort of detachment built into it.
Well, you see this problem particularly in effective altruism, right? Which I and others have been very critical of, a kind of a continual attempt, or not an attempt, a tendency towards quantitative reasoning. And, you know, Will MacAskill, in particular at Oxford, you know, has been guilty of this, I feel, and various EA activists, and the individual just really gets shoved under the bus. And I think the what's ironic is that if you don't start from a point of view of fundamental respect for persons, then the utilitarian project is going to undermine its own goals. I mean, it's the way that Singer's going around saying conscientious omnivorism is okay. Whoa, let's think about this. You're saying that we can fundamentally disrespect the personhood of all these beings by killing them, and yet that can happen without us causing them suffering. Well, just empirically, we know it's not true. Karen Davis has done, you know, a lot of research through, you know, United Poultry Concerns about what the humane myth does, actually, right? Putting chickens in gas chambers, you know, CO2 chambers on organic farms, etc. So again, I think that utilitarianism, its principles end up being self-defeating. And it's not that we can't take insight from utilitarianism in terms of like thinking about the consequences of our action, trying to make people happy. These are good things. But if you don't fundamentally, but there are other values besides suffering and pleasure to take into account. And I think love, for example, is an intrinsically important quality, whether it leads to happiness or not. In fact, love makes us vulnerable to grief and suffering and loss. So from a utilitarian point of view, you can say, oh, we'll just get rid of that because it's going to lead you to, if you love your cat, you're going to be crushed and devastated when your cat dies, as has happened to me and many, many millions of people. Well, the problem is it's a mistaken view of the nature and purposes of existence and the human condition. Because a world without love is a world that's even more unthinkable than a world without happiness, I would argue.
Yeah, and I think there's a broader risk as well of almost any moral philosophy that has a sort of maximizing tendency built into it, because it almost seems that depending on your conclusion, you're either driven to think maybe we should, you know, ultimately exterminate all sentient life because that's the only way we can get rid of all suffering. Or on the flip side, you think, well, actually what we need is the maximum number of industrial factory farms where the animals have a slightly net positive life and we can just cover the planet and maybe other star systems with it. And I'm sure there is some middle way between eradicating experience and maximizing experience that is more attuned to the interests of each of the individual sentient beings. And that can absolutely include us taking the choice that, you know, to have a rescue puppy or a rescue cat in our home and have the pleasure that comes from that. We know there will be suffering along the way as well, but that's up to us to decide. And ultimately, it's about what we as the other, you know, want and care about. It's not about some independent outside evaluation of that on our behalf. There's a sort of arrogance there too. So, yeah. Well, we've started to come on to this final question about how can we make a better world in the context of everything we've talked about. And in a sense, I guess that's a good place maybe to talk about the omnivore deception, because what you're describing there is the topic to do with non-human animal exploitation and in all of its forms is not just, you know, another cause to add to the list. It's actually a fundamental civilizational error we've made with catastrophic consequences. So as we talk about how to make a better world, it'd be interesting for you to just sort of lay out what you think that error is and why we've come to it. And also, you know, what's the best way of putting it right? Because there are lots of people, I think, who would agree with your diagnosis that it's a terrible catastrophic error, and many people who are working in different ways to address that. But again, you know, you have disagreements with many of those philosophers and many of those movements about how they go through it as well. So it's too big a question to ask. Well, you know, what is that civilizational error, and how can we put it right, do you think?
Yeah. So, you know, in my first chapter, my preface, as it were, to my book, I've entitled it A Trivial Matter, because we really do think of our relations with other animals as a trivial thing. You know, most people do. I mean, you know, maybe not watching this broadcast, but other people do.
Yeah, it's a dietary choice or an aesthetic thing or a product choice or a...
Yeah, yeah. And so, you know, take climate change discourse. You know, there are people who are saying, oh, we have to, you know, eat a little less meat. You know, let's have meatless Mondays, which is like, to me, when I hear that, I think, okay, well, I'm only going to commit sexual assault on Tuesdays and Fridays, and I'm not going to be a racist on Wednesday. Like, what? That would not be... it's so interesting to me that animal issues are so trivialized, right? That we as a society tolerate, accept antithetical views and treatments of animals as morally equivalent, whether we brutalize and kill this animal or we love this animal, they're seen as, those are both acceptable and they're the same thing at some level. Of course, they're not the same thing. Ontologically, they're not the same. They're not the same ethically, right?
Yeah, from the perspective of the other that we're talking about.
Absolutely. And but also, you know, what I'm doing in my book is also looking at what this does to us, right? That we are making an existential choice to organize civilizationally existence, the human condition, around mass violence, violation, mutilation, murder, for any other, you know, lack of a better word, genocidal violence, that scale. People have no idea what's going on, actually. You know, most people have not seen a film like Meet Your Meat, for example, and people don't have a sense of the scale of what's happening. So, but if you pull back, you see that animal agriculture, just taking that, and not even looking at fishing, right? Animal agriculture is arguably the largest cultural artifact ever produced by our species. I mean, literally, it dwarfs everything else we've ever constructed on the earth, including our cities and roadways, just in terms of its physical volume. But it isn't just that. It's that psychically, culturally, socially, economically, everything that we've done and built has been premised on not that. In other words, being against the animal other, right? So we see ourselves as to be human. If you look up like the word person in the Oxford English Dictionary, at least my version of it, you know, it says, well, a person is to be distinguished from either a thing or the lower animals. By definition, a human is a person, and that's that. So this civilizational error has now led to an ecological apocalypse. The entire ecosystem of the earth is collapsing, and it isn't just global warming. The most important problem of our day is mass species extinction. And that's partly a function of global warming, but it isn't primarily due to global warming. So all of these pathologies that are leading to the destruction of life on Earth really come down to this mistake, this civilizational mistake of treating other beings as objects, as things of use, rather than as, in Martin Buber's terms, as thous, as say, as persons to be respected. And so if we hope to save ourselves, we need to have a new ethos and a new ethics and a new politics in our relation with other beings. The problem with environmentalist discourse right now is it continues to treat other animals purely as objects and instruments of our own needs. The reason environmentalist organizations will say the reason we should protect the honeybee is because we need the honeybee to produce honey. We need the honeybee to pollinate our crops. The idea the reason it's bad that all the bees are dying from bee colony collapse syndrome, the reason that's bad is actually because it's bad for the bees. Actually, let's start with that. So it's like a gestalt switch. We have to get away from this idea that the reason that we have to change our relations to animals is because it doesn't work for us. We need to have a kind of compassion.
And just on that point about the environmental movement, I mean, that's one of my personal bugbears, because quite often when I'm talking about sentientism, as I said to you before we started, one of the first times the word was used was actually to criticize it from an ecocentrist point of view. And I'll get this today from environmentalists. They'll say, look, why do you focus on sentient beings? We should be caring much more generously about our entire ecosystem, rocks, rivers, trees, the earth as Gaia. But the vast majority of those people, at the same time as claiming a generous ecocentrism, have carved out basically all of the sentient non-human animals from their moral consideration. They don't really care about the individual animals living free-ranging in the world, and they certainly don't care about the animals living in our farms, because most of them continue to eat them. So it's not actually an ecocentrism. It's a sort of weird moral scope donor with this layer still carved out. And that gives the lie to it. It makes it very clear it's just a veneer on another version of anthropocentrism, because they don't actually have an ecocentric concern. The reason they're interested in nature and the environment is because it looks pretty and because we need the ecosystem services to have happy, comfortable lives as humans. And I'm probably being a little bit harsh because that certainly doesn't describe all ecocentrism.
I don't think you're not being harsh at all. I mean, I completely agree. And, you know, the environmentalist movement has engaged in this kind of category mistake of ontological conflation, where, as you say, rocks and rivers and trees and animals, they're all lumped together into nature. And therefore, they all have a kind of significance only within a totality of usefulness or whatever. And it's a very strange thing. And the what gives the lie to this, of course, is that those very same people will grieve the loss of a human in their life and perhaps their own cat or dog. But I mean, they don't actually treat other humans as rivers and streams and rocks. So it is indeed an anthropocentric worldview. But the irony is, again, it's like the utilitarian thing. You can't get there from here. You can't get to the point of wanting to actually do something to protect the living Earth and its beings unless you care about the individual beings who are affected and who suffer. You know, and so it's self-defeating. As long as you continue to represent nature in commodified terms, like, well, what nature gives you get this World Wildlife Fund or whatever, they'll actually put a monetary value on nature, nature's service to the world economy. You know, it's giving us $10 trillion worth of services. If that's really if you take that instrumentalist view, the game's over. You're never gonna get out of the paradigm that's led you into the hole in the first place. We need a completely different way of viewing other beings.
Yeah, and you can see that in the fact that I think in the academic world, but even amongst the public, there's reasonably widespread acknowledgement that maybe we need to grant rights to rivers, right? But people are more willing to grant rights to rivers than they are to farmed animals or wild animals. And, you know, I don't mind using rights as a form of protection for aspects of the non-sentient environment. Fine, that might be the right legal and moral structure to use, but you can't deny them to the sentient being, surely. And another example is the concept of ecocide, right? This is a new term that's coming through the discourse of, you know, actually we recognize homicide as a crime, a terrible crime. We recognize ecocide as a terrible crime. But the only person I've ever heard of use the word, you know, senticide or something similar, right, to killing a living being is me, basically. You know, it's just not even a concept. Whereas to me, it seems to be central. But and the way you've framed that story as a civilizational error, when you set that against current human social norms, that is a deeply radical, shocking point of view, deeply radical. But at the same time, it flows so simply and so directly and so obviously from the very simple ethical stance you were describing, which is, to the extent we can, understand the perspective of the other and care about that, right? I mean, it's so self-evident. But as we're talking about how to make a better world, I'd love to be in a position where people would read your book or listen to this podcast or, you know, listen to ethical arguments and just genuinely switch that stance, switch that worldview, and the light would go on. Unfortunately, it doesn't seem to be the way that many humans work. Most of my guests seem to work that way, but we're a pretty weird bunch. So in that context, what are your thoughts about how can we fix this crisis? Is it just to, you know, relentless moral persuasion, or what else can we do? Because I know you're quite critical of quite a few of the sort of established movements that are trying to find ways of making it better.
So a couple things. One is, you know, I have this essay on bad faith, which is a concept in Jean-Paul Sartre's existentialism. And I think it's important to think about bad faith. Bad faith is a kind of self-deception, which is really kind of what my book is about. It's not just about, like, it's not just that the meat industry is propagandizing everyone, which is true, importantly true. But it's that people don't want to know what's going on, and they don't want to rethink their life values and choices, you know.
We're desperate to be propagandized. We're desperate to be deceived.
Absolutely.
You know, and that bad faith is the core for you. Yeah.
Yes. Yes, absolutely. So the problem cannot simply be cured through giving people the right information. oh, well, here's a pamphlet, which is not that we have to keep it up and keep educating, for sure. But I think it's very important to understand that moral suasion isn't enough, right? That because there are these deep psychological cultural reservoirs of violence and aggression against other animals, that's a big part of this. And then, you know, in terms of what can be done practically, I think, you know, no one has the silver bullet for that. I will say that the animal system is imbricated with, intertwined with the capitalist world structure. There's no way to get around that. That the commodification of animal life, the destruction of animal life, the destruction and humiliation of human life, the exploitation of most human beings on earth by this system is the huge part of the problem. There's no way to have animal liberation under capitalism. It's another lecture, but this is just unimaginable.
So you don't see any path for a compassionate capitalism where the consumers and the producers and the governments, you know, all share our ethic basically, but it's still working under a. You think exploitation is built into capitalism?
It's built into it because the nature of the commodity system, first of all, is to mystify the nature of production. That's why, you know, we don't know how our own clothes are made, and you know the poor schmo in Bangladesh who had to do this to feed her kids, you know, that's all hidden from view. And it's the same with where our cow's milk comes from. That's all hidden. The nature of the commodity system is mystification of the origins of production. That's number one. Number two, you can't have production of goods without exploitation of nature, because nature has to be a kind of free resource for the capitalist. So you have raw commodities that you can turn. So even if we went to an all vegan world, well, guess what? The orangutans are still going to be homeless and orphaned because Cargill is cutting down, is doing monocrop production of palm oil, or like, you know, we can't disaggregate the question of animal agriculture and fisheries from the larger scale ecocide or ecological catastrophe that is destroying the conditions for animal life on Earth, right? You know, now they're talking about mining, doing more mining in the oceans, right? That's not a vegan question per se. It's about the structure of capital realization, capital accumulation. So that's, unfortunately, that's a big part of it. Patriarchy is a big part of it. How we're socialized to fear, quote, effeminacy, or, you know, showing, that's just showing weakness. And if you care about, you know, someone else, if you watch these rodeos, you know, where these big guys, mostly men, right, and mostly white men, not all, but are just wrestling down these calves and tying them up, or, you know, I mean, there's this, it's a performance, right, of masculinity. They're gonna show them, you know. So all of these issues are very closely tied together. The bottom line is we need a movement or a series of movements that tackles the structural nodes of the system. In other words, it's not enough to go around and convince your neighbor to become vegan. That's great. We also have to pay attention to the state economy, socialization, all these other things that go into the making of this pathological earth.
Yeah. Now, and many people will, I guess, agree at least with your diagnostic that this is a genuine sense of fully systemic issue, right? It's about epistemology, it's about ethics, but it's about social norms, it's about power, it's about institutions, it's about governance, it's about, and all the way up from us as individuals all the way up to the UN, right? So it's an enormously complex problem. And many of them will look at that and say, well, in that sense, we need to, you know, pull all the possible levers we have, and some of them will be incremental, and some of them will be institutional, and some of them will be about just making the change easier for these people, even if they haven't, you know, yet got the ethics. And on the one hand, I see, you know, I'm sort of quite enthusiastic about that, because I think the problem is so enormous and so deeply entrenched, we need to sort of try everything. But at the same time, there are some challenges with a more incremental approach, or approach where you're making this journey easier for people practically, because there's a risk of actually bypassing the core ethical issue. And I know you've criticized things, you know, ideas like clean meat and some aspects of the effective altruism movement, and as you talked about, sort of incrementalism and welfareism and meatless Mondays. is that the core of your issue there, that you're worried about that ethical bypassing, or do you just think those techniques won't work? Because I should stop rambling on, but in the conversation I had with Mike Humer a while ago, for example, he was sort of almost laying out a cynical but positive path, which was saying, you know, we'll get clean meat, everyone will switch to it because it'll be cheap and tasty, and then it will free people to adopt their latent ethics, because who would want to harm non-human animals? Whereas other people are worried that, and you might be one of these people, that if we go down that clean meat path, we bypass the ethical transformation we need. Who knows what horror we'll do next, because we haven't done the ethics.
Oh, I completely agree. I mean, yeah, there's no work being done. If you're just getting people to buy a tastier product or cheaper product, you're actually not chipping away at the central problem of civilization. You're not looking at the nature of our contempt, really, for other life forms. And in fact, you're reinforcing the triviality of these other beings' lives and interests by saying, you should try clean meat because it's good for the environment and it's healthier and it's less fat. And, you know, and it's garbage, by the way, that people are going to switch to that, because it's a misunderstanding of the nature of meat, which has a whole semiotic and cultural history that's tied in with power over nature and animals. And so, yeah, a certain number of people will become, you know, it's like today, people who are not vegetarians will buy Beyond Meat burgers. And I'm glad they're Beyond Meat burgers. I think they're actually great. But as a transitional object or something, but there's no latent, you use the word latent, I love that, there's no latent ethics of compassion or love for animals in its, you know, that has to be inculcated.
Isn't that why bad faith is bad faith? Because underneath it all, there is a latent ethic. You know, most people don't want to kick a puppy. Most people wouldn't push a knife into the throat of a pig.
Okay, well, that's, you know, that's no. Yeah, no, okay, I grant that. That's a fair point. That's a fair point. I just don't think that people just don't give a shit about animals. They just don't. They don't care. They don't care enough, to the extent that they do care, and they don't get them in a lot of ways. Now, there's something to build on there, because, you know, people, it's not like there's nothing there.
Yeah.
But no, you know, when I talk to people in ordinary life, they've never heard the term speciesism. I talk to PhDs, wherever, they don't even know what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
If I say, well, they ask me, what's my book's about? Well, it's about our violence against animals, this system of domination. They have no idea what I'm talking about. So part of what, you know, socialists have needed to do for 200 years is to shine a light on the totality, which is the big enchilada of the way the social system works, so that people can see it and you can turn them and say, aha, look, there it is. It's the same with what we do to other animals. People see it, and this is partly the animal rights movement's fault. I mean, welfareists in particular, but, you know, they get a news story that comes up on their feed or something about, oh, some puppy mill, when there's been all this puppies that have been da-da-da, or they see, oh, the elephants are going extinct over here. They don't understand that this is the basis of human material life, and that it has all these aspects to it. So yeah, just, I'm sorry to go on so long, but just to agree with you, yeah, unless we're challenging people's understanding of what and who other animals are, and spotlighting our violence against them, then I don't think there's any work being done. No matter how much clean, quote, cellular clean meat you're going to have, there's no reason why people are going to buy it, even just because it's cheaper. And a lot of other things that, you know, the meat producers will find a way to get subsidies, so it's even cheaper than the clean meat.
Yeah, thank you. The process of that ethical transformation and ultimately persuasion at an individual level, at a societal level, given the power of social indoctrination and parental indoctrination, that is a long, long, painful road. But at the same time, if you look at other social justice movements, things can switch pretty quickly, right? You can tap into something and things can change. And you can look back a few decades and go, you know, okay, we've still got a long way to go, but look at where we were, right? So I'm hoping that can happen for this topic. One of the things that blocks it is the sense you mentioned earlier on, that the non-human animal topic is siloed and niche and treated as distinct and separate. And one of the ways it's kept separate is because of an understandable nervousness and hesitation about talking about the parallels between the non-human animal subject and human social justice causes. And one of the impressions I get from your work is you're pretty unashamed and comfortable at drawing those parallels as a way of making sure it cannot be a niche topic. It has to be part of the central suite of issues we're facing. And to my mind, that does link into, and you touched on it already, some of the sort of human political dynamics. And I find it fascinating how you can look at how animal agriculture and exploitation plays into human political dynamics, and whether it's Jordan Peterson or Andrew Tate, you know, extreme examples of people on the far right who seem to have this really interesting cluster of values that align very strongly with animal agriculture, right? So you have the role of animal agriculture being on the front lines of colonialism because it's so land hungry. You have the classic might makes right justification, which is I'm doing it because I have the power and I can do it. You have this sense that compassion is a sign of weakness, as you said before, and the sort of macho idea that demonstrating your power is a way of showing, you know, you're successful. You even have some slightly bizarre situations where white supremacists will chug quarts of milk to demonstrate that they're lactose tolerant as a sign of their, you know, racial supremacy, right? So there's a whole cluster of crazy shit stuff on the far right that is really quite tuned in with animal agriculture. And you can see it coming through and people promoting the carnivore diet and actively being proud of their immorality in essence, right? In the same way as they sometimes are for intrahuman ethics. So that's fascinating. And I should stop rambling on, but I guess part of my frustration is the rest of the human political world, right, who aren't in that far right quadrant or however big it is, don't seem to be ready to take the other side of that argument. So if you look at, you know, liberal Democrats or social Democrats or progressive people or boring centrists or whoever else, right, all of the people who are supposed to be in favor of, you know, universalism and kindness and compassion and doing the right thing and thinking broadly about moral scope and trying to be good people and try to be caring, those people don't seem to be taking the other side of the issue yet and jumping on board. And do you think that's, you know, by linking the human issues and their nature, the underlying psychological and social and power problems with the animal issues, is that a way you think we can get at least the rest, the decent bulk of humanity on side? Or
yeah, well certainly I would argue that the left tradition ought to be interested. I mean, the political right, as you say, is a tradition of hierarchy, authority, machismo, violence, aggression,
othering.
So the left, which is ostensibly a movement for liberation, against injustice, you know,
solidarity, anti-oppression,
yeah, right. So it's a natural, you would think it would be a natural, and it is. I think that there are real reasons why animal liberation is a left issue or should be left issue, but leftists are human beings and therefore suffer from the same anthropocentric biases and ideological acculturation that everybody else does, right? So that's the problem. And I think, though, because capitalism really interferes with our ability to grasp the nature of the production system, including the nature of the fisheries, the nature of animal agriculture, the nature of the biomedical exploitation of animals, that's really strategic. So that's why it's really important that we have an anti-capitalist politics, and that somehow we convince, you know, shake people on the left to say this. And I wrote an article on animal rights on the left in 1989, okay, for Z Magazine. So this is an old issue that the left doesn't want to look at. Partly for historical reasons, because of the way leftism has been tied to humanism, right, in a certain sense of the dignity of the human being, blah blah blah, and as part of that, just biases. But if we if animal liberationists really want to change the world, then they have to look at these other social structures. And the left needs to understand that, yeah, when Black people or people of color are compared to animals, the reason that's possible is because we view other animals with contempt, right? If you take that away, if actually comparing me to a, you know, another animal is actually, that's actually a positive thing, then it becomes harder to other humans. So there are all these ways in which the issues and the structures are linked. Absolutely. Very important.
Now, the final question I'm going to ask, and again, this is insane, given you probably only have a couple of minutes, is you talk about an anti-capitalist politics. Do you have a view of what that might look like? What sort of political economic structure do you envisage that avoids the risks of authoritarianism and oppression that so far have come through when people have tried anti-capitalist models? Do you have a view in mind, or is that too much to ask?
Oh, in 60 seconds, I can totally give my...
Yeah. I am so, so sorry.
Yeah. No. So no, this is it's great questions. I mean, certainly I'm in favor of a democratic socialism, not social democracy. Just to be clear, Bernie Sanders he believes in social democracy. He wants the best. Like, I've never heard Sanders say, let's get rid of capitalism. I do think that capitalism is something that has to be gotten rid of. But I'm part of the Western Marxist tradition, so I believe in democracy, right? I don't think a democratic socialism is an appealing one unless at the root of it has an animal liberationist conception of the world, a conception that's spiritual in nature, having to do with compassion and empathy, which are words that, you know, hardline, you know, Marxists don't want to think about feelings and yeah. stuff, you know, like yeah. that's a non-starter for them. So I think, but I don't see why we can't have all of these things in one movement, a feminist movement, you know, but that's yeah. just part of the politics. There was a second part to your question. What was the second part?
I think you've answered it, because it was partly about how do we avoid the risks of authoritarianism and oppression.
Oh, yeah. So I did want to say that there are, you know, there aren't that many, but there are historical examples of, you know, more equitable economic, say, social arrangement, like Salvador Allende's democratic socialist movement in Chile in the 1970s. There was not an authoritarian movement. Unfortunately, the US CIA helped overthrow him and staged a coup, you know, and then put in death squads and fascism. But, you know, so, yeah, there aren't that, you know, we mostly think of the Soviet Union or China or North Korea, these horrible, horrible totalitarian regimes. But there are democratic socialist traditions. Mondragon Cooperativa in Spain, which has been going strong for like 60 years or something. It's a network of worker cooperatives. That's a model of, you know, socialism, maybe not social, but proto-socialist economic organization that's cooperative, peaceful, nonviolent. You know, there's workers' movements in Latin America that are developing similar models. So I think that the last thing I'll say is I think that we're in this very, very dispiriting historical moment where we see a cascade of interlocking crises that are ecological, political, economic, social, cultural, spiritual. And part of this is what I would describe as a crisis of hope itself. I am not hopeful. I'll just be honest. I'm not at all hopeful. Based on what I see going on in the world, and I look at the history of this species, I do not see a learning curve. You know, as Theodore Adorno said, the progression of mankind, if there's been progress, it's been from the slingshot to the atom bomb, you know. That said, and speaking of bad faith, we have to try, you know. I think, you know, there's no reason we shouldn't be naive or to, you know, fool ourselves. But as Gramsci said, you know, we need a pessimism of the intellect and an optimism of the will. He didn't invent that, but he often spoke of that. And I think that's where we're at as a movement.
Yeah, and there's meaning in that. Yeah, yeah. Well, thank you. It's been absolutely fascinating to sort of explore your philosophical journey and get your thoughts about how we can make a better world, however tough that might be. So thank you so much. What's the best way of people following you, keeping in touch? I'll include in the show notes a link to your website and to your forthcoming book, of course. But is there anywhere you'd prefer to point people?
Thank you. I just created a personal website for the first time. So anyone who is interested, just go to johnsanbonmatsu.com. So just my name.com, and you can find links to my articles and books, and then hopefully this interview. I'll have a link up at some point.
Yeah, absolutely. And The Omnivore's Deception is coming out in 2024, isn't it?
Yes, that's the plan.
That's the plan. Yeah, good luck.
Yes, I'm just finishing it up now. That will be coming out with NYU Press later in 2024.
So. That's brilliant. Well, thank you so much for being a guest on the Sentientism podcast. It's been a genuine pleasure, John. Thank you. Please stay in touch.
It was an honor. Thank you, Jamie.
Thanks for listening. You're helping to normalize rational, compassionate thinking. Don't forget to subscribe, leave us some stars or a review. You can visit sentientism.info to find out more, and you'd be very welcome in any of our online community groups. The biggest is on Facebook. If you like what we're doing, why not tell your friends about us?